All right, 2 Kings chapter 6 is where we are. We've been looking at the kings of Israel and Judah. And right in the middle of 1 and 2 Kings, the narrative primarily about the kings, pretty much all of the miracles of Elijah and Elisha are grouped together, particularly the miracles of Elisha grouped together from chapters 3 and 4 up through about chapter 8 of 2 Kings, which is where we are. So we left off last week in 2 Kings 6. Verses 13 through 17. This is where the king of Samaria had sent his army down to Israel. He found out where Elisha was, and he had the city surrounded. Verse 14, he sent thither horses and chariots and a great host, and they came by night and compassed the city. In verse 15, the servant saw it the next morning and said, "What are we going to do?" Verse 16, he answered, "Fear not, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them." Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. And that was, you know, symbolic of God's presence and God's protection. So he sees that, but then, you know, what happens with that? That's really where we left off. Now we're going to pick up in verse number 18. When they came down to him, Elisha prayed unto the Lord, and said, "Smite this people, I pray thee, with blindness." And he smote them with blindness, according to the word of Elisha. And Elisha said unto them, "This is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." But he led them to Samaria. All right, now, what was the significance of Samaria in the time of Elisha? Anybody remember? There was a lot of idolatry there, for sure. But politically, what was the significance? Yes, it was the capital. So the king was there, the armies were there. You know, he led them right to the capital city, which is where you would not typically start if you're trying to start a war. Okay? So he said, you know, he asked God to smite them with blindness, and then he went to him, talked to him, and said, "Follow me." So it doesn't seem like it's complete blindness. It's almost like they had a similar situation to the young man, Elisha's servant, where he said, "God, I pray, open his eyes." I mean, he could see. He saw the host around him. There were just things that were withheld from him that he could not see. And when he says, when he prayed and asked God to smite them with blindness, I think what happened there is he asked God to dull their perception. So they saw him, but they did not recognize him. They didn't realize this was Elisha, and they were blinded to the reality of what was going on. Well, that sounds a little bit like our world today, doesn't it? It would probably be true of most every age. There are people that are seeing things but blinded to the reality of what's going on. But, you know, God withheld recognition from the whole host of Syria. He's like, "Hey, this is the wrong city. It's, you know, I'm going to take you to where you want to go." And they followed him to Samaria. Verse number 20, "It came to pass when they were come into Samaria that Elisha said, 'Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see.' And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria." Whoops. This is not where we wanted to be. Verse 21, "The king of Israel said unto Elisha when he saw them, 'My father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them?'" Can you hear the urgency in the way it was repeated? The excitement, the urgency. That was his goal. Now, I find that phrase, "my father," very interesting. Who was the king that would have been the king in Samaria at this time? You know, quite possibly it's Jehoram. But regardless of who it is, what was the religious persuasion of all the kings of Israel that reigned in Samaria? They're idolatrous. It was Ahab's father who moved the capital to Samaria. But his father reigned there, Ahab reigned there, Ahab's sons reigned there, and grandsons. So the king, all the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel were idolatrous. None of them followed the Lord. It was, I would say, more of a cultural mention when they talk about the Lord, or historical mention as the God of Israel. It was not sincerely held religious beliefs. And we can identify with that today, people talking about the Lord, but it's not a real relationship with the Lord. But the king of Israel would have been an idolater. And then what does he call Elisha? "My father." A term of respect. No, a term of authority in a sense. So he's acknowledging Elisha's position, acknowledging his power, if you will, the power of God. My father, I mean, he doesn't always treat Elisha with that kind of respect, does he? In fact, later on in this chapter, he's going to have a very different view of Elisha. But he spoke to him respectfully in this instance. My father, shall I smite them? Shall I smite them? Verse 22, he answered, thou shalt not smite them. Wouldest thou smite those whom thou hast taken captive with thy sword and with thy bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. All right. So you have here the answer of Elisha was very different. Verse 23, he prepared great provisions for them. And when they'd eaten and drunk, he sent them away and they went to their master. You see the ethics of war here. If you're paying attention, it was one thing to be on the battlefield and to fight for your cause and defend your life and, you know, that kind of thing. But here, when the king, probably Jehoram, said, hey, Elisha, can I kill them all? He said, really? Are you going to round up captives of war and then slay a bunch of innocent people who are not harming you? That was the comparison made here. You see, you know, the expectations. There was a difference between the battlefield and then just killing people to make a political point or killing people because you can. Verse 23, he prepared great provision for them. Now, most of you can probably identify with that this week, right? If you're hosting or, you know, you're preparing, you know what, you know, preparing great provision is. Probably the refrigerators are full and the freezers and the counter space and, you know, preparing for Thanksgiving time. But they laid out a great feast. This is reminiscent of what Jesus said in the Gospels, is it not? If thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. Do good to them which persecute you. That's what Elisha told him to do here. So they fed them and they sent them home. Okay, at this point, they have been embarrassed. They've been humiliated in a sense. They were misled. They put themselves in a very vulnerable spot, and they were let go. They're not going to attack. They're just going to be happy to get out of there with their lives at this point. Okay, so Elisha has a victory by simply, you know, asking the Lord to withhold their understanding and then leading them to Samaria and then letting them go home. They all went home knowing that they had been whipped by the prophet of God. Even though not one of them had been killed, they again would have recognized the power of God, the superiority of the God of Elisha to the gods of Samaria and to the gods of Syria. So you have this story in with Elisha at Dothan, but then it leads right back into verse number 24. It came to pass after this, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered his host and went up and besieged Samaria. Now, likely there's a period of time here between verse 23 and 24. It's not necessarily the next week he went back, but within a relatively short period of time, whether it was a few months or whether it was a couple of years, the king of Syria is named here in verse number 24. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered his host and went up and besieged Samaria. That was very common in those days. But, I mean, we can identify with some of this in our country. In the late summer, when it becomes hurricane season in the Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico, you know, if the storm comes the wrong direction and it comes in where the oil pipelines are or the oil pumping, and what happens when a big hurricane comes in? You know, they shut it down. I hope it's legit and not just an excuse to jack the prices up. But, you know, they shut down the production. And then there's all this, okay, are we going to get it back in time? Are we going to have enough gas? You know, that's all it takes to interrupt the flow of things. I mean, when things shut down majorly in 2020, and then they just kind of slowly ramped up, you know, we learned what it was like to have a different style of supply in our stores, right? That's one thing that Jed and Gloria and the Limas and the Duartes and others that are in Brazil are facing right now, because these road blockades mean that the truckers are not getting through with groceries or, you know, fuel or supplies. I mean, they're like America. America's very similar in that a lot of things that go to the stores and all across the country are delivered by truck. only on the very coast do you get it, you know, on a boat, but still it's going to be transported by truck to the stores. So, I mean, Jed and Gloria are looking right now at the possibility of stores not having food for a while if a war breaks out or even if the protests shut down the roads and all those kinds of things. It doesn't take very long to get supplies interrupted. I mean, it can be done those ways in our days, but in Bible days, if they brought an army and they camped around your city, what did they do? They cut off all the roads. They cut off all the access. There was no Amazon drone delivery to fly in and, you know, drop a package inside the city wall. You know, there was no alternate method of delivery there. So a lot of times, if it was a fortified city, they would simply encamp around it. They had access to the outside. They could get food, water, supplies. And basically, they would just camp there and wait you out. They would try to starve you out, is what was happening in a siege. And we see that, you know, many times in the Old Testament. But what happens here is the king of Syria decides he's going to do that to Samaria, which is the capital city there in the northern kingdom of Israel. Verse 25, what was the result? There was a great famine in Samaria. All right, a famine is a shortage. In this case, a shortage of food. Behold, they besieged it until an ass's head was sold for 80 pieces of silver. Okay, now, any of you ever bought meat in bulk? Like maybe you got a half a cow or, you know, quarter. You ever bought, you know, or butchered sheep, goats, cows, deer? You know, how valuable is the head and the meat that's on it? That's what goes in the garbage, right? I mean, that might be what you throw out in the yard and let the dogs play with, right? Who's taking the head? That's not very, I mean, maybe somebody does, but that's not very common. You know what I'm saying? It was not a ribeye. It was not a brisket. It was not even donkey steak. I mean, this isn't even a cow's head, you understand. This is a donkey's head. So they had used up all of their normal supply, their sheep, their goats, their cows, whatever. They can't get in and out. The donkeys were their transportation, but at a certain point, I can't feed the donkey and feed my family, so I kill the donkey and try to feed my family. They're eating donkey meat at this point. And then eventually that got so scarce that the head of it, which would have very minimal food value typically, was sold for 80 pieces of silver, 80 shekels. Okay, you're talking about, you know, depending on the economy, a month's wages or more, potentially. I mean, in the New Testament, it was a coin a day. It was a denarius, the penny, but, you know, it was a coin a day. And if there's any sort of similarity, I mean, you're talking about a week's, a month's wages or more for a donkey's head. How desperate would you have to be to spend a week's paycheck on that? I mean, I know how some of you, or many of you, probably feel about liver. I know that's a polarizing topic. Either that's a delicacy or you're like, you know, you can have it. I mean, the liver is the body's filter, so when I pull out a dirty filter, I throw it away, but, you know, that's just me. But, you know, something like that would be a polarizing enough topic, but they're not even talking about liver, they're talking about the head. You're in bad shape at that point. Look at the next thing in verse number 25. The fourth part of a cab of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. So that very well could be literal. I have read some commentators who have equated this phrase to some of the other languages, Syrian or Aramaic, Akkadian, some of the other Eastern languages there, and they have argued that there was a particular kind of vegetable that had a similar appearance to dove's dung. It was not highly valued at all. It was what you did not want at all. I mean, it was not a delicacy. It was the leftovers. Now, I mean, we could take a poll and see, you know, for some of you, that'd be carrots. You know, nobody wants carrots. Some of you like them, you know. Could be celery, could be water chestnuts, could be whatever, you know. But whatever, some of the commentators argue that the phrase is dove's dung, but some of them argue that there was a kind of grain or vegetable that was called that, right? Either way, the point remains, it was undesirable. Mm-hmm. I tried to hold a straight face. I'm sorry. That's horrific. That's horrific. Yeah. Right. I mean, the context, it could be potentially for fire to cook something, but when they're talking about a donkey's head, they're not using that for fuel, so it seems like they're talking about the food prices. But, you know, possibly it was fuel, but either way, whether it's literal dung or whether it's the most despised food, a cab, as I looked it up, a cab is kind of the smallest dry measure. You know, you had bushels and measures and stuff. But as I understand it, a cab is a very small measure. Like one book that I looked it up in equated it in cubic inches. So I did a quick calculation. All of you know what a Rubik's Cube is, right? A normal Rubik's Cube is about 3 inches. Well, if I did my calculations correctly, the cubic size of a cab is about the size of a Rubik's Cube. So what is that? 2 cups, maybe? A cup and a half, depending on what we're talking about? A cab was sold for 5 pieces of silver. Again, you know, multiple days' wages for that small amount of whatever, for fuel or food. These people are in bad shape, right? They're desperate. That's what has happened. Now, remember, this is the people of Israel, but God uses these kinds of things to judge them for their idolatry. God allows these things. But you see, the food prices were, you know, bad. So, you know, when you go do your Thanksgiving shopping, that, you know, some of you have already finished it, some of you are doing that this week, and you look at the food prices, and it's like, oh my goodness, just, you know, it could be a little worse. Or at least, last I knew, Ingles was still advertising turkeys anyway. You know, they're not advertising donkey's heads, so you know, we are a little better off than this. Verse 26, and the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, there cried a woman unto him that said, help, my lord, O king. But you see the food prices. You see the desperation on the part of the people. Now, passing by on the wall, what does that mean? I mean, the city walls were wide and thick and fortified. Very often, the defenses for the city, there would be troops posted on the top. There are descriptions of certain ancient cities that say that actually some of the larger cities actually held chariot races on top of the walls. That was for the crazy people. You know, those are the same people if you get on the Beltway around Atlanta. On the weekends, those are the people that have the hot rod cars, and they're racing the entire loop around, zooming in and out of traffic 95 miles an hour. I have witnessed it firsthand and do not care to do it again. But, you know, the walls were very often, you know, that was a place where the soldiers were, so it could have been visiting the troops, encouraging the troops. But remember, what's the situation they're in? They're in a siege. So there's an army encamped around them. So if the king's just trying to get a visual assessment of has anything changed, they're still there. You know, is there any way that we can sneak somebody through and get some help, get some supplies, get another army to come help us, whatever? He's kind of surveying the situation. But being on top of the city wall like that, he's also very visible. He'd been wearing his king's robe and such. And so one of the people of the city saw him, and a woman cried out and said, help, my lord, O king. Verse 27, and he said, if the Lord do not help thee, whence shall I help thee? Out of the barn floor or out of the wine press? The barn floor would be, you know, the harvest or the storage place. He's like, we've run out of all supplies. The wine press would be, you know, that they would use to process their harvest. He said, look, stores are empty, if I'm going to use modern day terminology. Warehouses are empty. How am I going to help you? I think in general, as a standalone statement, that's a tremendous statement to underline and meditate on. If the Lord doesn't help you, how am I going to help you? You know, the reality is, if you're gonna try to win someone to the Lord, if the Lord doesn't help, what are we going to accomplish? If you're trying to minister, if the Lord isn't blessing it, what are we going to accomplish? I mean, that's a good thing for us to remember. Lord, I'm going to do my best, but if you don't bless this is a waste of time. But that, as a standalone statement, there is truth in that. If the Lord doesn't help you, how am I going to help you? But remember who said this. Who said this? It's Jehoram, an idolatrous king of Israel. I mean, he's been worshiping Baal, and now all of a sudden it's like, well, the Lord's going to have to help you because I can't. Why didn't he say if Baal doesn't help you? Interesting. Baal was in charge when things were going well, and they blamed the Lord of Israel when things were going poorly. Does that sound like anybody you know? You know, if we're doing great, it's because we're successful, and you know, if we're not, you know, why is God treating me this way? But as a standalone statement, I do think that has, you know, some tremendous value for us. If the Lord do not help thee, when shall I help thee? In other words, I'm going to do everything I can, but I've got to have the Lord's blessing, or it's wood, hay, and stubble, not gold, silver, and precious stones. Verse 28, the king said unto her, what aileth thee? So she just said, help, king, and he basically said, I can't help. And then he said, what aileth you? He said, I don't think I can help, but I'll listen. What's your request? What's your problem? Okay? Verse 28, he said, what aileth thee? And she answered, this woman said unto me, give thy son, that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. Can't imagine. I mean, I try to imagine that, and my brain just kind of cuts off. It won't go down that road. What kind of desperation would that be? I mean, a mother's instinct is usually, I'll give myself on behalf of my child, right? To get to this point, what kind of craziness is going on here? Either they're widows, or, you know, maybe the children were, you know, born illegitimately. And so, you know, there wasn't a dad. It just seems like there wasn't the men in the picture at this point. But what kind of desperation is that? Verse 29, so we boiled my son and did eat him. How do you do that? I cannot imagine. If you can imagine it, I don't want to know. Okay? That's just horrific. Verse, but the rest of the verse, and on the morrow, I said to her, on the morrow, or on the next day, give thy son that we may eat him. And she hath hid her son. That's more like what would be expected. That's how bad it was. Has Jehoram at this point renounced his idolatry and repented and turned to the Lord? No. He's getting ready to blame God and God's messenger, Elisha. But God is allowing the pressure to be very intense. His judgment on them is very intense. But this is a great example of the desperation that was there. When you get to the point of cannibalism, you know, you run out of options. Verse 30, it came to pass when the king heard the words of the women that he rent his clothes. And he passed by on the wall, and the people looked, and behold, he had sackcloth within on his flesh. That sackcloth was their sign of mourning, okay, grieving. The normal way that it was done was the sackcloth was worn next to your flesh. Sackcloth would be, you know, think burlap sack, rough, not like smooth, soft cotton or polyester or whatever else, you know, you've got. This was very, and normally it would be worn more like an underlayment, you know, like a t-shirt or an underlayer close to the skin, right? It was an irritation. It was also a form of, you know, self-denial in, you know, trying to show that I am hurting and seeking God's help. But when he tore his outer garment, they people could see that he was wearing sackcloth and he was mourning and whatever. Was this his own doing? Was this something Elisha had put him up to? We're not told, okay? But he was mourning. A couple of times, some of the prophets put on sackcloth as an outer garment. That was a message to the people. I mean, that was supposed to be a visible sign to them. But, you know, very often the way they would do their sackcloth for mourning is that it was an underlayer, which would be closest to the skin to irritate and rub and all of those kinds of things. So the king is like, if the king himself is to the point of sackcloth and mourning, you know you're messed up. Verse 31, then he said, God do so and more also to me, if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day. Now remember what I pointed out in verse number 21, my father, shall I smite them? At that point, he's treating him with respect, recognizing his authority and his office and whatever. And now he says, this is all Elisha's fault, or very likely. This is all the fault of the God that Elisha represents. And since God's doing this to me, I'm going to take it out on God's representative, God's messenger, Elisha. So the threat is Elisha's going to be dead by the end of the day. I'm going to have his head. Elisha's very bothered by this. Not really. But look at verse 32. Elisha sat in his house, and the elders with him. And the king sent a man from before him. But ere the messenger came to him, what does that mean? Before the messenger arrived, he said to the elders, "See ye how this son of a murderer has sent to take away mine head? Look when the messenger cometh. Shut the door and hold him fast at the door." Elijah was really worried. He's like, this guy's going to try to kill me. He's sending somebody to get me. So, fellas, when he shows up, just lock the door and don't let him in. Notice what he says here. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him? He said, just lock the door. Let him make racket. Don't worry about him. His master will be coming after him when he doesn't show up with me. I wish I always had that kind of confidence that the Lord was going to take care of things. You know, we should. We know that. That doesn't mean we do. But Elisha's like, yeah, don't worry about him. You know, he's going to send somebody, just lock the door. Eventually he'll come himself. And Elisha had a message from the Lord that he was going to deliver. But sometimes people are upset with you, and sometimes they're upset with the God we represent or the message that we deliver, you know, that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. In this case, Elisha's not offended the king. The king's decided to take it out on. Verse 33, and while he yet talked with him, behold, the messenger came down unto him, and he said, behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? That phrase there, what should I wait for the Lord any longer, makes it sound like Elisha had told the king, all right, just hang on, you wait, and God's going to bring deliverance. So the king's like, I'm tired of waiting. I got people boiling babies. I mean, waiting on God has done absolutely nothing. I know none of you have ever thought that, right? You've never been in that situation where you think, man, you know, I'm trying to wait, I'm trying to be patient, I'm trying to pray, and nothing happens. Only this wasn't a spiritual person having that perspective. This is an idolatrous king of Israel. It's like, what good does waiting on God do me? Chapter 7, verse 1. Then Elisha said, hear ye the word of the Lord. Tomorrow, about this time, shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel. All right, that's about a half a bushel, if I understand it correctly. How much is a measure? Is about a half a bushel. How much was going for 5 shekels? About 2 cups of not even fine flour. It was refuse. I mean, 80 shekels for a donkey's head. Nobody wants donkey's head if they can get fine flour and make fresh bread. I mean, the fine flour was the stuff that had been ground and sifted. Everything that we buy in our stores today would be considered fine flour. Okay? Others would have been more like if you grind it yourself, or you get the more the coarse ground stuff. But they've been, you know, a donkey's head for 80 shekels, a cab of dove's dung for 5 shekels. And I said, look, you're going to get a half a bushel for 1 shekel tomorrow. Or 2 measures of barley, which would have been a little bit lesser quality, but, you know, twice as much, in the gate of Samaria. So he prophesies food after the famine. I mean, that would be the equivalent of saying today, all right, I know we've been paying, you know, at sometimes $4 a gallon for gas, but this week you're going to get it for 59 cents a gallon. Yeah, all of you are looking at me like, boy, that'd be great, but I know that's not going to happen. Okay? It would be like saying, you know, hey, milk's going to go back to 79 cents a gallon. Or, you know, mayonnaise will be something less than $5 a jar. You know, be $1 a jar for mayonnaise. I mean, you think about it, put some modern corollaries on it. It's just as foreign to their mindset. You know, if we were to say, you know, gallon of milk for 79 cents. You're like, yeah, whatever. I still remember you know, after church on Wednesday night or sometimes after school in the afternoons, we'd stop by the grocery store on the way home. My mom would give me $2.12, and I'd go in and I'd buy 2 gallons of milk. You know, that was enough to buy, they were a dollar a piece and cover the tax. You know, I don't think I'll ever see that again. That just seems like a distant memory. And it was just as crazy to these people in their siege. They're starving. There's no supply. And it's like, yeah, you're going to be able to buy Sam's Club quantities for dollar store prices. Notice verse 1. Elisha said, hear you the word of the Lord. This is what's going to happen. Verse 2. Then a Lord on whose hand the king leaned. This is an expression that he was a king's advisor. He was a close advisor. Okay? If you remember back in chapter 5, Naaman said, you know, the Lord pardon me when my master goes into the house of Ramon and he leans on my hand. In other words, this was someone who was very close advisor to the king, very high ranking in the administration, so to speak. Then a Lord on whose hand the king leaned, verse 2, answered the man of God and said, behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, might this thing be? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not eat thereof. Now, where else do we hear that phrase, the windows of heaven? There's a somewhat familiar passage that mentions the phrase windows of heaven. Anybody remember? Yep, Malachi 3. It's the passage on tithing. The Lord says, you bring you all the tithes in the storehouse. And he said, prove me now herewith and see if I will not open up the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that you can't receive it. So the phrase, the windows of heaven, is a phrase that just represents overwhelming abundant supply, more than you need, more than you can handle, more than really we can comprehend. This guy, remember, he's an advisor to the idolatrous king. He's not a worshiper of God. He says, if God would open up the windows of heaven, there's not going to be what you're talking about. He said, yeah, you're going to see it, but you're not going to eat it. Verse number 3, there were 4 leprous men at the entering into the gate, and they said one to another, why sit we here until we die? Now, I think I've heard messages using that as a subject, and I think it's very appropriate. But, you know, under the application of that message is more powerful when you understand the underlying context. Why were the lepers sitting at the gate? There was a siege. There was an enemy outside. You know, the lepers were segregated from the main population. They were not allowed to intermingle with the main population. They were not to come into contact with otherwise healthy people. So even though there's an enemy outside, the lepers still were not allowed inside the city. You're going to die anyway. Leprosy's fatal. You're going to die anyway. We're not bringing you in here and make all the rest of us die because of this siege. So they're outside the gate. They said, why sit we here until we die? Verse 4, if we say we will enter into the city, the famine's in the city, and we'll die there. And if we sit here, we're going to die anyway. There's a famine in the city, we'll die of starvation. We sit here, we're going to die of starvation. Now therefore come and let us fall into the host of the Syrians. If they save us alive, we live. And if they kill us, we shall but die. We're going to die anyway. There's some logic in that, is there not? We're going to die doing what we're doing. And if we go over there, and they kill us, we're going to die sitting here. But maybe, just maybe, there's a sliver of hope that they'll make us servants, or they'll throw us some crumbs, or they'll have pity on us. Verse 5, they rose up in the twilight to go into the camp of the Syrians, and when they were come to the uttermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. Why? Verse 6, the Lord had made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said one to another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and fled for their life. That's interesting. I mean, that's consistent with the battle patterns of that day. I mean, we see this, we've already seen this, where the Lord rebuked Jehoshaphat for joining up with Ahaziah, the son of Ahab. It was very common to hire soldiers from another country to enlarge your army when you're going on a certain campaign. God let them hear the sound of chariots and horses. Was it the chariots, the same chariots and horses that were surrounding Elijah? I don't know. Didn't have to be. But God let them hear a sound, and they absolutely panicked. Now, if they're trying to run away from enemies, why in the world did they leave the horses? I mean, they left the horses and the donkeys and all of that. It would have, I mean, logic says, I can saddle my horse and I can get out of town faster. But when you're operating on fear, when you're in a moment of panic, logic doesn't usually enter the picture. Okay. When you're operating on fear and adrenaline, later on you're like, wow, that was really not smart. But fear calls us to do dumb things sometimes. And that's exactly what they did. They left everything. In fact, verse 8, when the lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and they did eat and drink. And we'll come back to that in a minute. What I wanted to see, when they came back to the city and told it, the king didn't really believe it. He's like, oh, it's a trick. Look down in verse 15. They went after them unto Jordan, and lo, all the way was full of garments and vessels which the Syrians had cast away in their haste. So they had an extra robe. It was interfering with their running. They chucked it off. Maybe they were in the middle of supper. You know, maybe they tried to gather their iPad, their cell phone, whatever the modern day equivalent of that would be. They tried to grab their photo albums. You know, whatever it was that they tried to grab on the way out, the panic continued, and they're trying to lighten the ship, so to speak. They're leaving everything they possibly can behind all the way out, a long way, all right? So God fulfilled exactly what he said through the mouth of Elisha. There's going to be food after a famine. Remember that guy that said, if the Lord should open the windows of heaven, could this thing be? Was he right or wrong? Oh, yeah, he's wrong. Can I ask you a question? Have you ever been bothered by the mockers? Have you ever been intimidated by a loudmouth? We're human. It's easy to do. But who was right? The man of God delivering the word of God, or the loudmouth scoffer? Okay? We've got to have the same... God gives us stories like this to remind us that we need to trust the word of God over the loudmouth scoffers. You know, we need to trust the word of God over the word of the unbeliever. So the rest of this story is tremendous in what they did. And we'll have to pick up there next time. But every step along the way, you see the power of God is superior to the enemies in the world. It's superior to the scoffers. And the application to us, I think, is very, very valid and very poignant. Okay? Trust the word of God, even when it seems crazy. And, you know, ignore the noise as best we can and move forward serving God, even when there's opposition.